it's not just about what you do when your hair's on fire. It's about what you do to keep from getting to that point.
We love you.
Don't play with matches.
Don't play with matches, Dave.
You're listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast, where HIPAA and humor collide to make learning fun. Your delightful hosts are Donna Grindle and David Sims. Relax. HIPAA help is on the way.
Welcome to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast. My name is David Sims of HIPAA for MSPs and Security First IT. And joining me as always is my co-host, Donna Grindle of Cardin.
Cardin.
Formerly known as Cardin Compliance.
I know, we still use it. It's just easier.
I know. You're just trying to do that whole Prince thing. I know what you're doing.
I know. And then I get to say, I'm the Don. It always works. Kiss the ring. So, trotting along in our day, we, at the point we're recording this, we're in midterm break of the HIPAA boot camp.
Yep.
And it's pretty exciting. I think everybody's given us some great feedback. So, I think we may be doing that virtual boot camp again.
Yeah, it's going well. We've had a couple of people says that they want to come to the live one as well as the virtual one. So that's interesting. Like you can't get enough abuse at one time.
Well, no, it's neither one of our faults either. So
All right.
Well, we got an exciting episode today. Let's roll, brother.
I know we have a guest today, but before we bring her on, where in the world will you be, Carmen?
Carmen. Consuelo will be. So I'll be in Newport Beach, California, April the 22nd through the 25th is the JAWS conference. And I'm speaking there on Tuesday morning, and we're going to do some fun stuff in LA with our partners, this gang at Sphere. Shout out to all of you folks. And then come back home for a day or two and head back out to Savannah for the Georgia MGMA conference. And then right after that, and June 14th, I'm going to the North Georgia Medical Group Management Association, and I'm speaking there. So we're bouncing around a lot.
Nice.
I know.
It's then fun. You want to take a little summer break, maybe?
I hope so. I got work to get done.
All right. So today we're going to dive into a topic that people love to hear about, but we're going to come at it from a different angle. We're talking cybersecurity all the time. This time we're going to talk specifically about cybersecurity and the law. And so, you know, because you always tell people we're not lawyers,
even though
we play one on the podcast, we did decide to bring somebody in who can better speak to this. So we're excited to bring in somebody who knows a lot about these things, how things can go wrong and what kinds of businesses when it comes to cybersecurity concerns of what that looks like. So we want to welcome Mitzi Hill. She's a partner in the Taylor English Duma Law Firm. Hi, Mitzi.
Hey, how are y'all today?
Doing great.
Good. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I'm not sure how Don ended up, you know, conning you to be on the show. And in some cases, it's probably not a good idea to understand the backstory of how you met. So I'll just ask, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I assume that's directed to me and not to Donna, since you know her.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't care about what Donna does.
So you're right. I'm a partner at Taylor English Duma, which is here in Atlanta. And we're a full service law firm, fastest growing firm in Cobb County. I have been in practice in Atlanta for about 24 years, handling a wide variety of technology and compliance measures. And in the 21st century, when you put together technology and compliance and legal, what you come up with is data security and privacy. Yeah. And so I started my career in private practice and then went in-house actually for a big chunk of my career so far, and have been, so I was in-house for about 15 years overseeing global compliance for a media company based here in Atlanta, and have been in private practice and overseeing Taylor English's data privacy and security practice for about 4 years.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and I went to college at the University of Alabama and law school at the University of Michigan, and really enjoy football season. And
we won't hold that against you.
Made my decisions accordingly.
Yeah, we won't get into the whole football thing.
That's fine.
We always banter about it because it's sad for David to go through football season. He's a South Carolina fellow.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. It doesn't often end well, but I stick in there with them.
Well, you know, you're a true fan. There's something to be respected there.
Yeah, I am. So.
We've got some great questions that I have been excited about asking you. I don't know about, you know, most people don't get excited about these things, but I will, you know, I always admit I'm a nerd.
Yeah. Anytime we can get a lawyer on the stand, it's just fun.
Yeah, we never know where this is going to go. But I made questions. I'm trying to be organized, which often it's just four or five words and we go with it. So in honor of your visit, we actually have things that we wrote down. But we're going to start with the thing of the all the states are going nuts. And I think a lot of that has to do with Equifax and a lot of the other things. And we've tried to talk about it a little. I mean, we talked about some of the proposals in North Carolina and the crazy one in Georgia about, you know, it's illegal to access someone's computer. You know, it would put MSPs out of business. That one was crazy. And so we know they're coming from all over the place. And I know that there's no way until any of them pass that we can address the individual. But we really wanted to see, is what we're seeing is crazy from a legal perspective, or is it something you're expecting to see?
Well, I think part of the reason you're seeing the states be so active, there are a couple of reasons. One is the states approach all of this data privacy stuff from the standpoint of consumer protection, because the United States does not have any kind of federal consumer data protection rules, with the notable exception of HIPAA and a couple of things in the financial services arena. And so all of the material that is gathered about you online, when you shop, when you browse, when you visit a portal, when you do an internet search, most of that material is highly unregulated, even if you're sharing personal information about yourself. And the states have been jumping into the fray because we don't have any overarching national laws to cover that stuff. It's also really friendly to politicians at the state level, because they can go out and say, you know, I'm protecting the citizens of the great and sovereign state of X by campaigning for your privacy online. And so voters tend to like that at the local level. So you see a lot of that. And I think what's interesting about what's going on in the states is, you know, there at any given time, there are multiple bills pending or being discussed, more accurately, in multiple state legislatures. There is really no meaningful way to keep on top of all of those. And there's really no reason to keep on top of all of those, because passing a bill is, it's a complicated measure. And frankly, a lot of things get proposed that nobody ever really is that interested in passing. They just want to be able to say that they're the champion of this bill at their state level.
You mean it's politics?
It is. Isn't that insane? But I think what's interesting about it is that the states are getting savvier and filling this gap left by the feds. And they are looking, you know, it started out with just kind of if your name and a little bit of financial information or your email address gets out, you know, then we have cause to be worried and cause to notify consumers about that. The states have gotten savvier in the last 10, 15 years about that. And they're looking at things like medical information getting out about their state residents, or shopping habits, or location data, or biometric data. Some states are starting to impose affirmative protection measures on certain personal information. And so they are really looking at the frameworks that have sprung up in other countries or in the regulated industries in the states, in the United States, and saying, you know, we'd like to have some of those protections apply to the citizens of this state. And what ends up happening is, if, you know, you could have, I believe right now 48 states have a data breach notification law.
I think Alabama's jumped on board. Finally.
Have they? Okay, so now we're go Alabama.
slow folks.
And, you know, it's the 21st century. They're coming along.
They'll get there.
And but, you know, what happens is you may have, you know, 47 states that don't care at all about a particular measure. And then if one state changes the requirements, if your business does suffer a data incident and you have to report it a certain way for one state, what you'll end up doing is reporting it that way for all of the states, because it's more cost effective and easier to report uniformly for everybody who was affected, no matter what state they live in.
Which is another question here is we have listeners all over the place, and thankfully, even shout out to our buddies in Hawaii.
Nice.
and all the other places that are far away from us, nobody's being neglected, but come on, Hawaii.
We just want to go to Hawaii.
We do. But how is it efficient for those of us who run small businesses and, you know, we're running around like a one-armed paper hanger, as they say. How do we even know how to keep up with our own state? Where can you get that information easily? Is it just by listening to Help Me with HIPAA is what we should recommend people do?
Obviously that would be the first recommendation I would make. There are some online, you know, there are some big DC law firms that track this kind of stuff and have bill trackers online. The National Conference of State Legislators has an online bill tracking that they update at the end of the year, so you can at least see what was pending last year. I really encourage people to read the trades that apply to their industry, because anything that's really getting momentum and looks like it's close to being passed would be reported in the trades. And obviously, if you've got a relationship with a lawyer, you can ask your lawyer to track this stuff for you too, and say, look, I'm really interested in knowing what goes on, and can you do a survey of what's pending across the country, and let's talk about an update schedule.
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, when we have to help people write policies and procedures, and you need to include the state requirements. And most people, they don't even have the first clue where to go look. So wanted to make sure that we covered that. But I know there's not a lot. It's a roll of the dice with the states, but I think more and more are going to start getting things done. It's just a matter of what. And does it involve healthcare as far as we're concerned?
Right. I think that's right.
And so then that takes us to the next thing I wanted to get your input on is the FTC and the SEC are both weighing in on all these cybersecurity requirements, particularly. And, you know, and by the way, David, we did meet when I went to a session on data breaches shortly after the Equifax debacle. Mitzi and her team were explaining just how much is going on there. So it was a great conversation, by the way. And when I said the NIST, CSF, and HIPAA, she knew what I was talking about.
Wow.
Which is, I'm like, I love this. Come on. But
I just always assume when you know a lawyer, it's usually because they got you out of trouble.
Hey. This is a cybersecurity lawyer. I don't have to talk to them for that reason. But, I mean, I see this happening, and granted, these are for public companies when you're looking at the SEC. But, you know, here we are in Georgia. We're aware of LabMD and the FTC. Is this going to continue spreading? You know, we got the states we're worrying about now. Are the fraud things going to start playing into this?
I think the short answer is yes. The attention to this area is going to grow. And how fast it grows depends on how many high-profile incidents like Equifax you have happening. You know, those get the attention of regulators for a lot of reasons. One, they start hearing from their constituents. And two, they themselves are affected by those incidents, right? And so it really makes them sit up and take notice. The FTC has been very effective at wading in on this absence of national legislation and saying, hey, we think we've got the authority to enforce some backward-looking, you know, privacy violation type investigation and rules. They've never really been granted the authority to set out standards on the front end and say, here's what you must do. And instead, what they've done is they've leveraged their power as the nation's consumer watchdog to say, if you have a privacy violation, we're going to investigate that as a consumer fraud or deceptive trade practice kind of angle. So not everything can fit under what the FTC has muscled its way into, but I think they are getting bolder and bolder about it. If there ever is a national consumer data privacy kind of regulation, it is likely that the FTC would affirmatively be granted some authority. But in the meantime, as I say, they seem to have made a pretty good niche for themselves, and the courts seem inclined to allow them to flex their muscles in this area. the SEC, as you mentioned, for public companies, what the SEC is now looking at is how are you disclosing your cyber preparedness and any cyber events that you have come across, because they're looking at this and saying that is material to anybody's investment decision in this company. And so they're not looking at it from the standpoint of punishing you if you've had a problem or telling you how to avoid a problem by adhering to a certain set of rules. Instead, they're saying, we believe that your preparedness, your business operations in that area, and any incidents you may have suffered are relevant to John and Joe investor out there, or, you know, Fidelity and the other big funds putting their money in your company.
I didn't think about it that way, but that truly is the way that they have the authority to look at it. And it makes sense.
It does.
We go on and on about making sure that you can trust the companies that you're doing business with, which takes a perfect segue. I've tried to line these up properly. GDPR.
Yeah.
I don't see it being a huge impact on healthcare necessarily, but anybody that's multinational has to be worried about this. And how much, David and I did a, well, we didn't do predictions. We did educated guesses. And David's big educated guess is that some of that GDPR stuff is going to end up hopping over the pond, so to speak. So can you touch on GDPR a bit? We've kind of stayed away from it for obvious reasons, but
sure.
I don't want to talk about it.
Well, GDPR is a big mess for a lot of American companies. It is the new set of data privacy rules that are coming into effect in the European Union in May of this year. There's been a two-year transition period, and people are freaked out about them for a number of reasons. One is that the definition of the information they protect is extremely broad and much, much, much broader than any definition of protected information in the states, whether at the federal or the state level.
Wow.
The second is that the rules explicitly say that they apply to activity conducted outside the European Union if it involves that very broad category of personal information about European residents. And the third, so they are explicitly saying we have extraterritorial, you know, application of these broad laws. And then the third reason people are freaking out about them is that the fines for non-compliance are massive. They are intended to hurt, and the maximum range of fines tops out at 20 million euros or 4% of global revenue.
Which
is a really scary set of numbers. So having said all of that about how scary it is, I think you're probably right that for a healthcare, you know, entity that's delivering services in the United States to American residents, the GDPR is unlikely to have a huge impact. But people need to look around the margins of their business and understand that the GDPR protects the data of not just your customers or your patients, but also employees and of the employees of your service providers who may be located in the European Union. And so if you've got cloud storage or server farms or transcription services or any kind of back office function that's happening in the EU, you may need to be looking at whether there are areas of your business, your data flow, what you've got in-house that needs to be protected under the mechanisms of the GDPR.
Ooh.
Yeah, sorry. It's a bummer. Now, the good news is, if you're not prepared and it does apply to you, you're in great company, because I think it was an E&Y survey a couple of weeks ago that asked something like 1,000 companies to self-report, are you ready for the GDPR? And as you might expect, the highest number of yes responses came from companies located in the EU, and they only got up to 66% saying, yes, we're ready. Wow. American companies said only 12% self-reported that they're ready. So there's going to be a big gap in readiness when these come into effect in May. And as you say, most American healthcare companies, it's not going to have an impact on their core operations. What they're going to need to look at really is their support function, their business associates, those kinds of things, and whether they have contact either with data from the EU or with providers in the EU who may be handling data.
Which is Okay, now this is one that, this is one of my soapbox issues, is offshoring in healthcare. I mean, that is a specific tie-in there because it's primarily the, a lot of this offshoring is in things like transcription services and call centers and that kind of stuff for the payers. And what ends up happening is your data is being shipped into another country where it's my understanding it's kind of hard to enforce HIPAA in India or somewhere, you know, another country. I use India because I'm working on three cases where there's a whole discussion about, you know, what is the impact of offshoring services, whether you're bringing your data or allowing access over there. And is that fear that I have about those business associates that are being, if they're in the EU, you got to feel better.
Right.
But if they're not, you know, I mean, and a lot of these offshoring deals are not in the EU. So,
right.
Am I right to feel concerned about these things and being able to enforce the HIPAA laws?
Well, I think what anybody who's subject to HIPAA needs to remember is that you are subject to it even if you're hiring somebody to perform a service for you. And mm-hmm. so if they drop the ball, they may face some liability, but you still face liability. You can't necessarily contract away all your liability to them even if you try. And the ability to recover from a business associate or a service provider who isn't in the States may be more difficult, particularly if they are in some of the jurisdictions that are a little less settled legally. As you say, the EU has a whole bunch of frameworks, commercially and privacy driven and those kinds of things. And so business partners there, you can pretty easily conduct some diligence on them. You can pretty easily understand their ability to cover a fine, for example, or be to handle an investigation or to respond in case of a problem. That gets a little harder when you start multiplying time zones and the legal regimes get different and that kind of stuff. And the bottom line is that you are generally still going to be on the hook. And so as much diligence as you can do, the better off you're going to be.
So what you're saying is I'm right.
I am saying you're right. I mean, I don't think it's something you can't do, but I think it's something that you have to have a smart approach to how you do it. And you have to understand who you're in business with and trust that they can protect your assets as well as you would protect your assets.
Well, and that's what, you know, our recommendation is, look, if you don't have to do it, don't. Mm-hmm. But if you do want to do it or need to do it, then you better be certain that you've got everything locked down and you're prepared for when things go wrong.
Right. I think that's right. I think any company of any size, whether they're in the healthcare field or not, the best thing you can do for yourself right now is have a plan for what happens when things go wrong with the data that you hold. Know who you're going to call. Make sure they know you're going to call them. Have a plan for internal communication. Have a plan for how how you investigate.
I could have sworn you've listened to our incident response episode.
I mean, it really, and one of the things, you know, the reason we hear about this stuff is that the headlines get driven by things like Equifax, you know, where something terrible goes wrong and now we have huge liability coming out of every angle you can imagine, consumers, regulators, you know, whatever it is. But the reality is that the time and resources you put into planning are just as important to your core business operations as they are to staving off any liability. I mean, I recently helped a client that's a small client. They're not in the healthcare space. They had a breach. It was legally defined as a breach of some employee information. It was not a hack. It was an internal accident. Somebody accidentally sent the wrong file by email. We knew who they sent it to. It was a small number of people, but it affected every employee in the company. And so under all the state laws that govern release of that information, they had to notify all of their employees and they had to go through the whole exercise of responding to a breach. And so even though this was small and not strategic and not malicious and not any of those things.
And not healthcare.
And not healthcare is still cost them $50,000 in, you know, legal and other support fees. And they had to get their insurer involved. I'm guessing their premiums probably went up. They ended up releasing the person who accidentally sent out the file. And so now they've got to recruit and train, you know, a person to fill that vacancy. I mean, the executives who were charged with handling the fallout from it spent the better part of 6 weeks to 8 weeks on the phone with me about 3 hours a day talking about, here's what we've done, here's what we're going to do next, here, you know, here's the plan for communicating through the CEO, here's the plan for communicating to the board, here's the plan for communicating to employees, here's, you know, the information that goes into our letter to the employees, here's the information that the call center that's going to send out the letters will have so that they can respond to calls they get once the employees get the letters. I mean, it's a massive operation, even if it's just a little bitty incident.
So if they had spent time with somebody like, I don't know, me.
Right, or
and,
me.
And had a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And had a plan, do you think it would have mitigated the expense? And certainly, you know, you're talking about the time. I'm assuming that's not part of the $50,000. That's a soft cost of the time that they've had to spend.
Right. Yeah, the $50,000 was actual dollars they paid to vendors. It doesn't count their
pocket.
It doesn't count their internal lost productivity.
Mm. Mm.
And you know, some of it they could have forestalled, right? I mean, they could have had some plans in place for who they call and how, in what order they notify people and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and made it at a minimum, they could have made it easier on themselves and probably spent less time themselves dealing with it than they ended up spending, because they were having to invent everything on the fly.
And that's a big thing that David tries to do. We were just talking about a client that he has, and that, you know, they don't, it's all patty cake together.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we have it. We know what we would do. We would call somebody. It's layers of that being
right.
Prepared is a huge piece of everything these days. And you're right. You've got to talk to somebody.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I think a lot of the reason people don't do some advanced planning is that, you know, one, it sounds like putting the new roof on before you have the hailstorm, right? I'm not going to spend money till I have a problem.
Yeah.
And so, and all of us have that reaction to things. But the truth is, whether you have any exposure to third parties or not, you've got your own assets and your own business operations. And having a plan in place and doing some preparing is good for your own bottom line. If you're a small company looking to grow, it's going to be better in the eyes of investors. If you're a company at scale, it's better for your business continuity to have a plan in place, because the other part of planning is not just incident response, it's also prevention. And so, for example, this company might have had some preventive measures in place, like the file in question could have been access restricted, or it could have been encrypted or password protected such that only authorized recipients could open it, even if it were accidentally emailed to them. And so they might have had some things in place that made that human error not quite so, it wasn't a catastrophic error even, but made that human error have less of an impact and made the whole thing much, much easier to deal with. And so that's part of what planning gets you to, is it's not just about what you do when your hair's on fire. It's about what you do to keep from getting to that point.
We love you.
Don't play with matches.
Don't play with matches, David.
Well, you bring up a good point. I mean, I know we're seeing states that are kind of taking a proactive stance on this. Do you, I guess kind of a little bit going back to the GDPR thing, do you see at the federal level, they're going to start doing something about the privacy and security of data, kind of like HIPAA does for healthcare, but it's going to be more widespread in general?
You're assuming they're going to do something.
Well, yeah, exactly. So I think here is my medium-term and long-term prediction on that. Long-term, yes, I think the federal government will have to do something in this country, because I think the rest of the Western world is pushing for data privacy and security standards that our businesses are going to have to meet in order to do business in those jurisdictions. And the expectations of consumers and the expectations of the companies that have to comply are going to bleed over here. And I think some of that will be adopted at some point here, because it will become a common part of doing business. In the short term, I don't know that there is enough alignment about anything for the feds to do much in this space, which is, you know, very complicated. But I think what will happen in the short term is that the courts that get cases relating to data breaches, whether they be consumer breaches or whether they be vendor-customer kinds of problems like the banks and Target fighting about who had the responsibility for paying for all of the customer relations that happened after the Target breach. The courts are going to be looking at those cases, and they're going to look at the contracts you have. They're going to look at things like the NIST cybersecurity framework or at the HIPAA standards and say, well, that's a reasonable way to approach things, even if it's not the legal standard that applies to this business. Everybody in the world is aware that there's a HIPAA standard out there and can figure out what it means. And so for your business, is it reasonable to completely ignore the possibility of a cyber event? Or is it reasonable to say, here's the kind of data I hold. Here are some things I could do that are pretty easy that would secure it or keep it from getting out or keep it from being usable if it got out. And here's how much money it would cost me to do those things. And I think that's the kind of stuff that's going to be adopted through our court process before we get to the point of having any federal legislation.
Well, okay. Then, so that then takes us great step on to my next area is, it's fair then, understanding that environment that you just discussed, that if I'm going to engage a business partner that is going to have potential impact, so in HIPAA we call that business associates, on that data. You know, we started vetting business associates, you know, years ago, and we get a massive amount of pushback, and we're still getting it, that, you know, you don't need to ask me these things. I told you I'm doing it. And you've already talked about vetting your business associates. How much is enough? And granted, there are some where it's 200 questions. So how much do you recommend that people do when they're vetting these business associates, particularly if they're going to have this level of access to everything?
Yeah, I think the answer to that, frankly, is it depends. It depends on whether you are a HIPAA-regulated business or a financial business, in which case you have a legal duty to do some of these things. If you don't have those legal duties, then I think it's going to depend a little bit on how sensitive the information is that you hold, whether it presents any third-party liability potential, or whether it's really core to your operations to keep it, you know, locked down. And, you know, I think for a lot of businesses, especially small and medium businesses, and especially those that aren't subject to these more complex technical regulations like HIPAA and high tech, you don't need a 200 question spreadsheet in order to assess a vendor's suitability. But what you do need is some discussions with them about your expectations and their capabilities. And you need some protections built into your contract that say what they do to protect your information, physical standards, administrative standards, technological standards, whatever it is. If you want them to meet a certain auditability or a certain technical framework, you know, you need to specify that. You need to have remedies in there that say that they will make you whole if they fail on those standards. And you need to have some discussion in your contract of what happens if they suffer a security incident that affects the information they hold that belongs to you or your customers. So when do they have to notify you? What triggers that? You know, who bears the cost of investigating it? Who bears the cost of notifying customers? Who controls all of that, you know, activity? Those kinds of things.
You would be shocked, I'm sure, to know that there are multiple cases that we have found where people will sign the HIPAA Business Associate Agreement. And then when you ask them questions about, well, who's your security officer? What kind of training do they have? They say not applicable.
Right, right. So, yes, you're right. I'm completely shocked that never happens. Never in my experience as a lawyer have I ever heard of anybody signing something like that.
They have no intention of doing.
That's right. They don't do it in the GDPR context either, I can tell you that.
My favorite is the answer that, well, of course I'm not doing it, but you got to sign that to get work in healthcare.
That's right. That's right. And you know, if you're the covered entity and you honestly believe they're doing what they're supposed to do, you know, that does give you a level of protection. If you're the covered entity and you know that they are not able to meet the commitments they're making to you, you know, that makes your own exposure problems worse if you ever have an issue. And so it's not just, I mean, knowing who you're in business with is not just about what's written down on the 200 question questionnaire. It's also about trust and integrity.
Yeah, there's a point where trust has to play in.
Of course it does. You can't vet everything to the nth degree.
But when you look at, and you know, I mean, particularly businesses like mine and David, we joke and say ours are micro, not small. He's booming now that he's merged, and he's, you know, he's going to become a big
moving on up.
Yeah,
so, to the east side.
But when I look at this as a business owner, if I were, you know, I'm advising these companies, and if I was in their position, and some of these people they're agreeing to do business with, and their responses, it absolutely terrifies me. Mm-hmm. Because I look at it and I say, you know what? You can say, well, my contract says I'm going to get this money out of you, but if your whole company is not worth what I know it will cost when this thing goes wrong, what does that help you? You know, it just doesn't.
Well, if they have insurance, it helps you a little more. And that's another thing that you can look at in your contract is seeing whether that, you know, having a vendor or a supplier carry an appropriate type and amount of insurance. But you're right. If the company can't make good on its promises to you, not only the promises about the service they're going to deliver, but the promises about what they're going to do when everything goes south, you know, chances are very good there's another vendor out there who can do the service and be a partner to you when things are not going great.
And I think that those people who aren't doing it, they're going to need to, you know, pick up their game.
I think like any half measure, you know, cutting corners on that, kind of making sure that your partners are trustworthy and diligent and capable and, you know, all of those kinds of things. It may save you some pennies on the front end, but it will almost certainly cost you dollars on the back end. Yeah. One way or another.
Yeah. But, you know, I look at it and I see it as my personal liability as the business owner. We did see a case that we talked about a great deal earlier or last year where the MoneyGram deal where the compliance officer had cut a deal, so to speak. Is that because we constantly have people very concerned in their role as a HIPAA compliance officer and, you know, you often don't get the backing from the C-suite, so to speak, in their jobs, and they get concerned about it, and they'll say, I don't look good in orange. It is not the new black for me. And, you know, so is that something we should be concerned about?
The MoneyGram case and a lot of the other cases that involve, I mean, so I think there are a couple of things to tease out there. One is you can always look for some executive to take the fall for a company that has a major high-profile incident. Sometimes it's the CIO, CISO, CTO types. Sometimes it's the CEO. Sometimes it's the lawyers. It kind of depends on the company culture. And there is not a really good way from the outside of predicting how that will fall. From a legal liability standpoint, some of that personal liability stuff, generally speaking, that is going to attach only when you have some extra degree of culpability, not merely a data breach. And so in the MoneyGram case, I think that guy was actively helping to conceal fraud. So he knew there was some fraudulent practices going on, and not only did he not report it, but he was actively helping to cover it up. That's bad. You know, you saw in the Uber case, the Uber breach last year, Uber had a problem and then tried to pay off the people who made them aware of the problem. That's mm-hmm. bad. You know, Equifax, we've seen a lot of reports about, I mean, just this week, their CIO was indicted for having, essentially for insider trading, right? For having mm-hmm. sold stock in the wake of the breach, because he should have known about the breach. And, you know, there's a whole lot we could talk about based on the news reports on Equifax.
Yeah.
But we won't. But my point is, generally speaking, criminal liability and personal liability are going to attach only when you have a heightened degree of bad behavior. They don't attach just to the company suffered a data breach because somebody screwed up. Usually that screw up has to be something more than just negligence or accidental or, wow, we completely missed this. It's usually about making decisions in the aftermath of a problem that cover it up or make it worse.
So that whole thing, by the way, we're going to put a link in an interview you did that was on YouTube, a local show that it had some great information about doing a risk analysis and a lot of other things that there's no way we can cover in one of our episodes. And
right.
You know, we would love to have you back again, and we will probably beg for that.
Oh, I'd love to come. Thanks.
But there were some points that you made in there and I think that what you just covered is very, it's no longer that the C-suite can go, well, it's the IT people's fault.
Right. That's right. And no, you can't. I mean,
David loves that. He would like to hear more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is really a cross-functional deal now. And I think the reality of where we are in 2018 is if your company has a problem and the plaintiff's bar or the regulators or anybody else comes calling, you can no longer say, wow, it never occurred to me that this might happen, because I think everybody's on notice that any company connected to the internet is vulnerable. And you can no longer say, well, this is why I have an IT department, is so they can handle this. Because preparing for it, addressing it, responding to it, you know, trying to avoid it, that's not just a function of the decisions that the IT department makes. That's about executive leadership from the top. It's about setting a tone and a culture for the company that makes it clear that confidential or private or personal information is an asset entrusted to the company, and that the company does everything it can within reason to protect it. And that's not just about the IT department saying time to upgrade, you know, our operating system. That's about everything that employees do with the confidential information that passes their desks.
Mm-hmm. So when IT is begging for you to upgrade your operating system from XP, you should be paying attention.
Well, you should certainly be having a discussion about it, you know, and what it will do for your company from a security standpoint, and why that's important for your company based on the information that you have, right? It's not mm-hmm. equally important for all companies. And so having an honest discussion about the risk profile that you have based on the kind of information you've got, how sensitive it is, how much of it you have, what you do with it, who else has access to it, how it's distributed around your company, those kinds of things, that's all independent of your IT function and really gets at, you know, kind of your company's view on privacy and data security as a whole without all the technological bells and whistles.
Indeed, which is... Yeah. I got one last area, and we're going to let you just cut loose on whatever you want to say here, because I know, you know, we've had multiple cases where we have problems getting people to understand that when they have an incident, we will say, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. whether or not it's a data breach, you don't wait until you find out that you have a problem. You bring in and get things under privilege with your attorney when you find out you may have an incident is what mm-hmm. we recommend. What kinds of things do you wish people knew before they're in trouble and they get to you That's kind of one of my things.
So I think the point of privilege is a really, really important one. A lot of companies, I think, are hearing the headlines and they are rightfully trying to do something to prepare themselves. And they go out and they hire a forensic security firm to come in and do an audit. The security firm audits, does a gap analysis and says, here are the problems I see. And the company makes some decisions and says, all right, we'll resolve these three out of the 10 that you found. None of that discussion is privileged. If you never have a problem, it's okay that it's not privileged. But if you ever do have a problem, all of that discussion, the problems that were found, the problems that were deliberately not fixed, is eligible for discovery or production in an investigation. And so somebody's going to be second-guessing all of the decisions you made as a business operations matter in the aftermath of an incident. And so having a lawyer on board for any of your planning activities, whether it involves a security audit or it doesn't, is really important because it gets you privilege from the outset. And so from a planning standpoint, I would say that's multifunctional and ideally would include a lawyer because then you've got somebody directing everything and helping to preserve the argument that there's a privilege attached to it. From a proactive standpoint, the other thing I would say is talk to your insurer now and get cyber insurance now. I am advising a client right now who has suffered what looks like it could be potentially significant exposure of transactional and other records relating to about 270,000 customers. And the first we don't know how much of it has been accessed, but we believe much of that was exposed. And one of the first questions I asked is, do you have cyber insurance? Well, the company was going through the underwriting process when this incident happened. And, insurance can take a lot of the sting out of having an incident because if you buy the right kinds of insurance, it will cover your first party losses and your third party losses. So hiring the lawyer, hiring the PR firm, hiring the forensic service to investigate a problem, all of that can be covered by your insurance if you've got insurance and if you notify them as soon as you know of a potential problem. From an incident response standpoint, I completely agree with your advice, which is call your lawyer as soon as you think you have a problem. The first thing you need to do, though, is stop the bleeding. And so if you believe you have an active issue, that's when you do call your IT folks or your outside network support folks, whatever you've got, and say, figure this out and stop it or pull the servers down if we need to cut off access that way, whatever we need to do.
You don't want to take the tech support call?
I would not be very useful on the tech support call. I was an English major. And so, I talked to a lot of engineers in the course of my day, but I am not an engineer. And get that done first and call your lawyer and call your insurer. And, get that team together. The other thing I would tell you as part of your planning is make sure your team knows who they are, right? Make sure your lawyer knows, I'm going to call you if I ever have a problem, or your PR person knows, I'm going to call you if I ever have a problem. And make sure you can get in touch with people. You hear a lot about cybersecurity planning right now. And I think a lot of us assume that means, really drawn out technical discussions about network architecture and data maps and all that kind of stuff. But the reality for most small and medium businesses is it simply means having a common sense flowchart approach to who's going to get the calls, how do we make calls if our emails are down, do we have an updated cell phone list, if the HR director left last year, have we plugged in the new name and the new cell phone? It's those kinds of decisions and having it accessible and easy to get to if your network is taken down.
Okay, so we do have to clarify one thing and be very, very certain about this for all of our listeners and my clients who will listen to this. Mm-hmm. David and I did not pay you to say everything that we agree with. We did not pay you. And you have not listened to all of our podcasts. So,
no.
I'm over here. I'm ready to start doing the happy dance because it's
good.
You get us. You get us.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this all sounds very mysterious and very intimidating. And the reality is it's just smart business planning in the 21st century. And that's true whether you're a highly regulated business or whether you're not. If you're a highly regulated business, you have some legal incentives to do this because you are going to get your hand slapped if you don't do it. If you're not a highly regulated business, you may or may not have legal incentives to do this stuff, but you certainly have operational and financial incentives to do this stuff. And you're going to get a lawyer involved if you ever have a problem, even if you're not a highly regulated business, because they're going to help you drive how you respond to it and to whom you have to disclose it and what you have to say and how quickly you have to say it and all of those kinds of things.
You're awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, I think y'all are awesome too.
No, to have anybody that could make me and David be this quiet and just totally captured with what you're talking about, you have no idea. You have no idea.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk to you both. And I just think this is really important. Our firm is looking at this and talking with our clients right now on a couple of different measures. You know, as I said, the headlines are driven by all the really scary kind of consumer data losses that drive a lot of third-party liability. But truly, this is a business operational matter. And one of the, and we are talking about it with our clients and calling it cyber for growth, meaning this is just part of your business planning. It's not, you know, don't think of it as a risk avoidance kind of or a compliance kind of task. Think of it as making sure that your core operations are able to keep going no matter what you're doing. And the best kind of quantifiable way I can point that out is to say, you know, the Target breach, which is now almost 5 years ago, obviously involved millions of consumers, and the consumer claims were settled by Target for about $10 million. It was a $10 million settlement. Target's total liability coming out of that breach was more than $100 million. And so that tells you something about the importance of the consumer claim to your exposure in the event of a problem. And most of that money was spent settling lawsuits with Target's credit card vendors as they thought about who's responsible for the breach that has happened. And that doesn't have to be a credit card problem, right? That can, if a breach happens, the customer and the vendor are going to be fighting about whose fault it was and who pays for it. And that's the part that's going to suck up your resources most of the time.
Well, that's definitely Consuela money. Yeah, that's one of our, anytime we talk about that much money, I say, my name is Consuela, and I'm here in Mexico to serve you, because that's what I'm my only options.
Got it.
All right, David, you going to add anything? I got too much. I'm overwhelmed. Even
are you verklempt?
That's the word. It's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, anytime I listen to somebody else speak for that long and talk about how right I was all along, I mean, I'm loving it.
Well, I'm happy you invited me on to validate you today. So
yeah, we had no idea how validating you were going to be. We feel so good.
I'm so glad. That's a great way to go into the weekend.
Well, and hopefully we can work out, get you on the show again. You and I have been trying to do this since, before the end of the year.
Yeah, I know. And I would love it. So,
well, we have absolutely enjoyed having you talking with us. And so the next time we get some listener questions and periodically we bring those along. And so I think it'll be great fun for us to have you on sometime later. And next time a big juicy case comes in, you can expect to hear from us. But
Sounds good.
But thank you so much. And we're going to have the links to your profile at the office, and it's got all kinds of great things and papers that you've written. And so we're big fans, and you can certainly promote our podcast anywhere you want to.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners, and you have just validated me too. So it's been a very successful morning.
Yeah. Well, Mitzi, how can folks get in touch with you if they want to get under privilege?
That's right. Well, our firm's website is taylorenglish.com. That's TAYLOR. And my email address is mhill, at taylorenglish.com. That's probably the fastest way to find me.
Awesome. Okay. Well, we're going to have to close this up. This is our longest episode ever.
That's because lawyers get paid by the word.
I'm glad you sent an invoice to Donna, not me.
but that tells you a lot. We've really enjoyed it. So thank you very much. And David gets to do his closing now.
Absolutely. Well, that's our show for today, folks. Please remember to follow us and share us out. This was an awesome episode to share, so I should be seeing this all over social media. Don't forget to rate us on our podcasting app. Help us spread the word. Always, you can send your questions to contact at helpmewithhippa.com. We may even feature those on the show. So remember, for Donna and myself, and I'm sure Mitzi will agree, HIPAA is not about compliance. It's about patient care.
You've been listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast, hosted by Donna Grendel and David Sims, the show created to help you with HIPAA. For more information or to ask us a question, visit our website at helpmewithhippa.com. Neither Donna Grendel or David Sims are attorneys, and they do not offer binding legal advice concerning regulatory compliance. The information in this podcast should not be relied upon or construed as legal advice in any way. Consult your attorney for legal advice concerning compliance with HIPAA regulations.